Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for December the 9th, 2019. This is David Corey along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. We have lots of new news and information for veterans and their families, so stay tuned. But first, over to Richard Hurley. Hello,
hey.
Richard.
Hey, David. How are you? And welcome out there, vet fans. We got another very interesting hour for you. And these two segments today on our show, the first one is on the new Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And then our second one, we will discuss the news of the interest of veterans about disability claims, appeals to the Board of Veteran Appeals, as well as the new procedure for BVA video hearings. I'm sure a lot of you will find that very interesting. I had my first one today, and I've got a few more this month. I want to remind you that this is a call-in show. We welcome your views, your comments, your questions. So call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. David and I will try to remember to give that number out during the show. But one last time, write it down, vet fans. It's 1-888-627-6008. Back to you, David.
Thank you, Richard. As our regular listeners know, our work for veterans has given us a front row seat to the human costs of war. That experience has motivated us to examine and publicize the full spectrum of the cost of war. That, in turn, led to the creation of our Stop War Today project. You can check out our website at stopwar.today. We're helping to publicize the work of the Cost of War Project of Brown University. Their website is costofwar.org. As well as publicizing the work of many other groups and individuals. And that includes publicizing the United States Institute of Peace. Now, as part of our work, we had the opportunity last year to interview Professor Emeritus Andrew Basevich of Boston University. Professor Basevich is also a retired Army colonel. Since retiring from teaching, he has continued with a prolific writing career, producing numerous books on American foreign policy. This year, he has also helped create and is the president of a new think tank called the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. The Quincy Institute's purpose is to promote a new U.S. foreign policy which promotes diplomacy over warfare in resolving international problems and conflict. This past week, on December the 4th, the Quincy Institute had its official public launching with a panel discussion on the future of U.S. foreign policy. Since our show, the Veterans News Hour, is only on Mondays, we were not able to live stream the Quincy Institute's launching event, but we do have a tape which we want to share with you tonight. It's definitely worth hearing. The discussion you will hear is moderated by Kelly Vlahos of the American Conservative publication and joined by Representative Ro Khanna, a Democrat of the state of California, along with Quincy Institute President Andrew Basevich and Quincy Institute Board Chairman Suzanne DiMaggio. This offers a sneak peek into the rigorous and the far-reaching conversation that the Quincy Institute hopes to drive nationally on these issues. So, Doug, if you'll please roll the tape from the Quincy Institute's launching event.
So I'm Andrew Basevich, and I used to be in the Army, and my voice projects. I'm the president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. On behalf of Suzanne DiMaggio, our chair, and our entire team, I welcome you to this launch event. Now, to add to the burgeoning ranks of think tanks in this city may strike some as gratuitous. We would argue, indeed, if it's true that today President Trump is ordering another 14,000 U.S. troops to the Middle East, we would argue that founding the Quincy Institute is both essential and long overdue. What do we seek to do? Well, put simply, we aim to change U.S. foreign policy. Now, to change U.S. foreign policy means first changing the way that Americans think about our nation's role in the world. Since the end of the Cold War, the foreign policy establishment in this city has defined that role chiefly in terms of amassing and putting to use military power. We believe that this approach has not served our nation well. And so we intend to promote an alternative approach based on some very specific principles: realism, restraint, prudence, and pragmatism. Now, critics will charge that we are isolationists. We are not. You saw that expressed on the video. We believe in comprehensive engagement with the rest of the world, engagement directed at advancing the cause of peace. In other words, active and creative diplomacy. Critics will say that we are anti-military. We are not. We cherish our soldiers and wish to shield them from the abuse to which they have been subjected over the past couple of decades as a result of ill-advised and mismanaged military campaigns. Critics will say that we are anti-war, and we do indeed believe that war is a profound evil, and force, therefore, should be used only as a last resort. But we are not pacifists. Changing the way Americans think about their role in the world, our role in the world, is a mammoth undertaking. Not the work of a year or 2 years, but of a decade, perhaps multiple decades. So we are, this evening, embarking upon what is likely to be a long journey. Yet the circumstances for starting could hardly be more propitious. We thank those whose generosity has brought us to this moment. We invite those who share our vision to join in our cause, regardless of party affiliation or political persuasion. No doubt, there's hard work ahead and many challenges, but we take on this task with eagerness and determination. With that, allow me to invite participants in a short panel discussion to come forward and join me on the stage.
I'm going to make sure that this, yes, it is on. Okay, thank you so much, Professor Bacevich. I can't tell you how honored I am to be here with the congressman and all of you. I am so thankful. There's so many familiar faces here, and then there are new faces, and I think that's a credit to Trita Parsi and the Quincy Institute and the goals of the Institute. When I had met with Trita about a year or so ago, when he told me about his plan to build an action tank, you know, to combat the Washington foreign policy establishment, the war establishment here, you know, I'll admit I was a little skeptical, and only because I had been in this town for about 20 years, and I had been through 9/11 and the wars and working in the media and working in Washington reporting, and I know how people, A, react to new faces, new kids on the block. But also I know how tribal this city is, and his idea for bringing left and right together, a transpartisan strategy for combating the military-industrial complex, the militarism of Washington, had been a dream of mine personally for so many years and so many people in this room. And it's to his credit that he's been able to bring all of us together. And look at the numbers here. It's beyond incredible. So I'm very honored to see his dream and Quincy's dream realized tonight. And I know there's a lot of work to do, but I think this reflects a moment here, a space and time where things can actually change. And I'm happy to be a part of this panel and to maybe get some conversation going about that. You mentioned a bit about what the landscape is and what the problems are. But can you and all of you talk a little bit about specifically our foreign policy today? What is broken about it? And where do you see the most opportunity on beginning to change it?
Can we let Suzanne and the congressman go first?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'll go first. First of all, thank you, everyone, for coming. Welcome. It's such a nice evening to have you all with us. And thank you, Congressman Kelly, for being with us, and Andrew. Let me just say, over the course of my career, I have watched time and time again possibilities of diplomacy arise out of hard work on some tough issues. And time after time, they're pushed aside. They're cast aside for coercion, for use of force. And it's been very disillusioning, to say the least. I thought, after the Cold War, we were supposed to cash in on this peace dividend. That was a hinge point in our history, an opportunity we missed. And then certainly 9/11, I believe, was another hinge point where we had the support of the entire world on our side. We had the moral authority to forge a new way. And what did we do? We got involved in a war that was illegal. So that was another disillusionment. And I think we're at a hinge point right now, for better or for worse, with the Trump administration. I do think that we have an opportunity to assess whether or not we want to chart a different course. This is an election year coming up. It's an important one. And my read of the American public is that they do. They have had enough of these endless wars. They understand that Washington is broken, but also that the foreign policy making decision making is also broken. So I think with Quincy, it's a very ambitious effort, but we want to just create the space for debate. We may not agree on a lot of issues, but it seems to me this is an issue that we can coalesce around, that we do need a new approach to the world. So I'm hoping that's what Quincy does, is really make it safe to come together, people of different persuasions. There are a number of persuasions represented on this stage tonight, just like we're doing, to have some honest discussion about how to advance U.S. interests, the interests of the international community, in a new and different way. I think the American people are ready for it, and I think they deserve it. So that's why I'm so excited to do this.
Well, first of all, congratulations to the Quincy Institute on a fantastic launch. At a time where Congress is about as polarized as you can imagine, it's nice to have a transpartisan effort on thinking about American foreign policy. And one area that Congress actually is not as polarized is on having greater military restraint and recognizing the need to stop endless wars. I've worked with Congressman Matt Gaetz, Congressman Mark Meadows, Congressman Andy Briggs on issues of stopping war. In fact, one of my friends saw the president in his box at the baseball game, and they said, well, there are all your friends on the war effort, and you weren't there. And I said, well, when it comes to stopping endless war, there is actually a emerging coalition on some issues, not in complete agreement, between progressives and some of the members in the Freedom Caucus. I would say that there are two things that are fundamentally broken. You have a disconnect, in my view, between what the American public wants and what the president ends up doing. You had a president who campaigned on ending endless wars and I think got a fair amount of traction because of that, and just today then announces that we're going to send 14,000 troops into the Middle East. Totally inconsistent with the way he campaigned. And so the question people ask is, why is that? Why is it that people feel a need to campaign opposed to these wars, but then when they get into the White House, something happens that leads them to continue a lot of the interventions? And the second thing that I think is broken is an insufficient attention on what it's really going to take to lead the 21st century. There is a consensus that China is a rising challenge to the United States in terms of leadership. But China hasn't been in a war since 1979. We've been in 40 conflicts. Now, my view is that we ought to win in artificial intelligence, in quantum computing, in the technologies of the future. In the Cold War, we were spending 3% of our GDP on science and technology, and we had a policy of talent acquisition from around the world, and that's how we won. And I don't think we have a forward-looking vision for what it's really going to take to lead economically, technologically, again, over China. And I'd rather that we have that kind of strategy than engage in these wars that aren't, in my view, advancing our national security interests.
Well, Congressman, I'd like to thank you because I know that you've been on the forefront of efforts to get the U.S. out of the war in Yemen. And you were successful last spring, I believe, with the House passed a bill, which the president ended up vetoing. But I know that there was a lot of hard work on your part, but also your efforts to take back the war powers, Congress's war powers authority. I know you've been working very hard and across the aisle on that, so we really appreciate it. Professor, I'd like to talk to you and move on from the point that you made about this disconnect, about these politicians who say one thing when they're on the campaign trail, and then they get to Washington, and it seems like they get sucked into the blob. All of these special interests that are hovering, working, sustaining the military-industrial complex, it seems to take them over, brainwash, Borg them. How can the Quincy Institute combat that? How do you envision this think tank and having an effect?
Well, you've put your finger on a very one of our central challenges, I think. And how to address it, I think, is by presenting the facts, arguing the case that our propensity for war has been foolhardy and has indeed done great damage to our country. One of the things that I'm struck by is the facts that are known but don't seem to resonate. An example, the Cost of War project at Brown University tracks the cumulative costs of our post-9/11 wars. The number now is something upwards of $7 trillion. What could we have done with $7 trillion had we not decided to waste it in the sands of Iraq and the outback of Afghanistan? A lot. So I think one of the things we need to do is to hammer away, consistently drive home the negative consequences that have resulted from militarism, because that's what it is.
I agree. Thank you. So, Suzanne, how would, and I know that I'm jumping around a little because we don't have a ton of time, but I'm curious if the Quincy Institute could envision a new foreign policy, and I know you've done a ton of work in Iran and currently in North Korea, but let's take the Middle East. How do you envision Quincy's position on how to change our foreign policy in a region like the Middle East, which is so problematic?
Well, certainly what Andrew just said, presenting the facts that in the Middle East we've expended a great deal of blood and treasure, and the fact is that we've really gotten very little in return for that, and the people in the region have suffered. So certainly making that case will be one part of our work. The other side of the work I'm more interested in, and that is ramping up our diplomatic efforts in the region. When you look at every single conflict in the Middle East, whether it's Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, there is no military solution to these problems. There is only diplomatic solutions, political settlements that must be reached. And one of my big worries these days is that, yes, President Trump tells us he would like to extricate us from these wars. But the problem is in the process, what he has done is he has obliterated our capacity to carry out the diplomacy that is necessary to leave the region in a responsible way. Quincy is not advocating for us to take our troops out the way he did in northeastern Syria. We're advocating that we have to do the work of diplomacy, the work of reaching de-escalation, conflict management, conflict prevention, conflict resolution. That takes, first of all, a State Department that half of the senior State Department officials have left the building. So we need to replenish that. We also need to beef up our presence around the world and put in real diplomats, not diplomats that buy their way to that position. There's so many things that we need to do. And so it's yes, military restraint. I see it as two sides of the same coin, military restraint on one side and assertive diplomatic engagement on the other. And I should say that diplomatic engagement should always be backed up by a strong military. But that military option should always be of last resort. We should always lead with diplomacy. And when I speak to people in the Defense Department and in the military themselves, that's the way they want to be used and utilized, is backing up diplomacy to resolve problems. So in the Middle East, we really need to face reality that these conflicts have only been made worse, violence, instability, by our military action. And we need to get serious about being a leader in diplomacy in the Middle East, in Asia, everywhere.
But Suzanne, wouldn't you also say that the tendency on our part to see the world as divided between good guys and bad guys, friends and enemies, is a bit of a problem. It results in a sort of an oversimplified perspective. And perhaps the time has come to reevaluate that lineup. Maybe some of those that we have taken for granted are our friends. Maybe they're not. Maybe some of those that we categorize as adversaries aren't necessarily friends. But shouldn't be sort of written off as governments that we cannot deal with in any way.
Yeah, we need a much more agile approach to how we deal with the countries in the region. For starters, I do think a critical mistake was made by us getting in on one side of the Iran-Saudi conflict. What we did is abdicate our role as a potential honest broker, maybe not as a mediator, but certainly as an encourager of Riyadh and Tehran to come to the table. And when you look at every conflict in the region, the solution runs through Riyadh and Tehran. We have to understand that. So instead of backing one side over the other, we have a bigger role to play, and that is encouraging dialogue, regional dialogue, and playing the role of a potential mediator, not as an inciter, not as throwing fuel on a fire that is already burning. I'm afraid that's what we're doing right now.
Yeah, you make a very good point about the State Department, and it's not only the Trump administration's State Department in which the ranks have been depleted. But this was a process that began after 9/11, in which all of these activities that should have been spearheaded by the State Department were shifted over to the military. So the military was not only fighting and killing people, but it was also it was tasked with, you know, government in a box and getting to know and the communities and building communities, nation building rather. And so a lot of the money shifted over, the money and the resources. And so you have an institution that should have been in place to do all of these things, to help these communities rebuild. But the military was doing it, and I feel like they weren't equipped, and I don't even know if they wanted to do it. But that's what we have now. But that also goes back to the question about who are the people who are in places of authority and stature and influence in Washington that are helping members of Congress make decisions about policy and bring to attention some of these issues. I know there's been an ongoing debate, and we had this recently at our foreign policy conference, about how to get people like us into places in Washington where we're making a difference and we have access, whether it be to members of Congress or the White House. And it's been frustrating because it seems like all the people who are spreading the influence are pro-military, pro-interventionist, you know, supporting that military footprint expanding. How do you perceive, like, Quincy making a difference in terms of making those connections on the Hill and elsewhere?
Well, they'll have an influence with me, but there are. I think that the Yemen effort was an example. I see Stephen Miles here, and with Win Without War, and a lot of groups that helped mobilize both with Democrats and Republicans to get the War Powers Resolution passed through the House and the Senate, and now we have an amendment that would stop spare parts going to the Saudis if they're. Would be used to bomb Yemen, which would ground their air force, and that has a very good chance of getting through the National Defense Authorization and having the president sign it. So I think that can have an impact. But I believe what's also important is to shape the conversation in the media. So members of Congress, as you can imagine, are sensitive to public opinion. And when you have op-ed after op-ed in the New York Times or the Washington Post or someone on CNN or MSNBC taking a particular point of view and ascribing military restraint to isolationism or to weakness, then that can shape the collective thinking. And so having people prominently on the editorial pages, prominently on cable news, prominently speaking out to create an alternative narrative, I think is as important as meeting with members of Congress. The final point I'd make is that in the famous John Quincy Adams passage of not going out to seek monsters to destroy, before that, he talks about how America should offer its prayers, its hopes, its benediction. So John Quincy Adams wasn't a cultural relativist. He believed in American exceptional values. I mean, we're a nation of entrepreneurship. We're a nation, in my view, the only nation working towards becoming arguably a first multicultural democracy in human history. We're a nation that has extraordinary research universities. And I think what we have to figure out is how do we export those values in ways that aren't tied to military interventionism and not get boxed in into saying that military restraint is about isolationism. And I think John Quincy Adams was brilliant at how he tried to grapple with that challenge.
Do you get the sense from your constituents and hearing from Americans in general that they're tired of war and that perhaps this is the disconnect that you're getting where politicians have to go out and say one thing and then come back and they do another when they get in Washington? Is it because at this moment in time, Americans are ready for change foreign policy-wise?
I do believe they're ready for change, and you hear that not just in my district, which is a liberal district, but if you talk to some of the conservative members of Congress, they would tell you they hear the same thing. But what happens, in my view, is when you have a president, you have people go to the president, him or her, and say, you know, Mr. President, if you do this, there could be a terrorist attack in our country. And you don't want to be the president who could possibly be blamed for some attack on our country. And there is, I mean, I've seen some of the briefings, not classified, just when they come into your office, and there is a culture of fear. And I think that that is partly what we have to overcome. And in some places, in Afghanistan, I mean, there is no good solution. But the reality is, since we had the last escalation of troops, the Taliban controls more territory than they did prior to the escalation, both with the escalation in the Obama and Trump administrations. And so how do we have a conversation about something not being a good solution, but sending more troops being worse? And I think that's something the Quincy Institute has to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, on that note, I mean, it's all well and good to talk about Americans being tired of war, wary of war, but one attack, you know, one escalation, one incident, does that throw everything into a tailspin? And how does Quincy react in a situation like that when it's really, when you're really countering this fear narrative that you know will come up?
Well, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to call Suzanne and tell her she needs to figure this out. There is no question that the shock of 9/11 still resonates. There's also no question, in my view, that while jihadist terrorism, if I can use that term, is a problem, it does not pose an existential threat to the United States of America. So it's a problem we cannot ignore, but ought not to be the focal point of U.S. policy. I mean, I'm not sure all my Quincy Institute colleagues agree with me, but I'm far more concerned about the impact of climate change on our country, on our society, on our children, on our grandchildren. Although I don't for a second think that a war with China is inevitable. Indeed, it must be avoided. I also believe that managing the transition of power relationships in East Asia, which doesn't simply involve China, is a massively complex problem that requires very careful attention on our part and is more important to the well-being of our country than indeed terrorism. And I guess the last point would be that because of our wrong-headed response to 9/11, declaring a global war, we've made matters worse. And it will only be when we recognize, and I say we, I don't mean just people like me, I mean that the foreign policy establishment acknowledges the magnitude of our error after 9/11 in declaring that global war.
I'd like to. I need to wrap up, so we'll have one more question. So I'm going to try to make it as broad as possible. I'd like to ask each of you, if you had to pick one narrative, one issue that you'd like to see the Quincy Institute tackle first, whether it be getting out of Afghanistan, climate change, Iran, North Korea, what do you think is the most pressing issue, and how do you think that Quincy could pursue it? Like, what's the most urgent issue today that you'd like to see pursued?
I say yes to all the issues you mentioned. I really can't pick one. I think my answer would be broader. Of course, I see us hurtling towards a new Cold War with China. That certainly worries me. That's an unnecessary Cold War that will mire us in issues probably for decades if we go down that. So, of course, I'm very focused on what's happening with North Korea and Iran, so I would put that up there too. But I think, you know, Andrew did hit the nail on the head. I think using the global war on terror as the organizing principle of our foreign policy making over these past couple of decades, if we can make a dent in moving us away from that, I would really retire a happy woman.
Congressman, I don't want to put you on the spot because you're not advocating for Quincy, but in terms of the issues that you think that are most salient or urgent right now.
I believe the biggest challenge is to articulate a positive vision for a foreign policy as an alternative to military interventionism. I think there's a growing consensus that the war in Iraq was a mistake. There's a growing consensus that we've been in Afghanistan too long. But the questions that need to be answered is, okay, once we withdraw in from Afghanistan, how do we withdraw and how do we assure people we can still maximize our safety? How should we have withdrawn from Syria while not having the Kurds feel abandoned? How should we be engaging with China in the 21st century while maintaining American leadership? How should we be engaging on climate change? I think the critique of foreign policy is fairly effective, but there hasn't been a sufficient vision for what the alternative will look like. And Americans, we tend to vote for inspiration, for aspiration. We need to have something that people will be drawn to.
Thank you.
So I get the last word.
You get to mop up.
So our team, members of our team, will tell you that whenever Suzanne says something, I respond by saying, I agree with Suzanne.
He does. He really does.
And I do tonight. But I will add, I agree with the congressman as well.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I have like about 15 more questions that I would like to bring up, but I can't.
We'll
so we'll have to do this again because there's so much to talk about. But I'm very excited that we've started this discussion. And so I'm going to end the formal portion of our program here. And please continue to mingle, drink, eat, and have fun. Meet new people.
Well, we'd like to thank the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft for their launch event tape and wish them success in their work. Their website, for those of you that want to learn more about the Quincy Institute, is quincyinst.org, and that's spelled Q-U-I-N-C-Y for Quincy, and then I-N-S-T for institute.org. That's Quincy, Q-U-I-N-C-Y, I-N-S-T.org, Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And you heard from Professor Emeritus Andrew Bacevich, who's the president. You heard from the board chairman, Suzanne DiMaggio. And you heard from Congressman Ro Khanna, a Democrat from the state of California. And it was moderated by Kelly Vallejos of the American Conservative Publication. Richard, what are your thoughts?
Well, it was all good stuff. You know, it's just more of, you know, the part of the BAR campaign for Stop War Today. And I think one of the things that was interesting, they were talking about, you know, what do we do going forward? You know, they were talking about how to get out of Iraq, how to get out of Syria. I think, and you and I have talked about this before, David, about, and this kind of goes in line with our theme of stopwar.com, which is before we engage in these conflicts, let's think all this stuff through. And maybe when we're thinking about engaging, we will also be contemplating, if we were to engage, then how would we get out of it?
Right.
And if we came to a conclusion that we could probably not get out of it cleanly, then maybe we shouldn't engage to begin with.
I think that's the key part, and I think that's where their proactive diplomacy is so important. It's interesting they made the observation of how depleted the State Department is. Something else, Richard, which really surprised me, was the silence, the absence of any mention of the United States Institute of Peace. You know,
yeah.
They're talking about beefing up the State Department, which is necessary, but it's as if the U.S. Institute of Peace, which you and I attended an event there, a seminar there a year ago in October, the Peace Convention, and it's as if it's almost invisible, which is very strange because it's literally right across the street from a portion of the State Department, and it's in an incredibly visible, visual, modern-looking building right there on the northwest end of the mall in Washington, D.C., and yet the U.S. Institute of Peace seems to be an unknown quantity, certainly for most Americans, as we've done our own sort of informal polling. But we'll have to see, and that's an issue that that I've actually posed to the Quincy Institute, and I'm waiting to hear back from them. Like, you know, what role do they envision for the U.S. Institute of Peace? They can't simply ignore it. They ought to be supporting it. But in any event, that's my two cents on the issue. But
David, as we found with U.S. Institute of Peace, that last year to October, when we were up north, and we referenced the organization, it seemed like everybody was walking on eggs around it. Nobody wanted to commit one way or the other. They didn't want to comment on it. So obviously, there's
yeah, that was kind of strange and very strange. And I don't know. I know one of the professors we talked to, the one at Harvard.
She cut me off. She didn't want to pursue it.
Had told you on the QT, taking you aside, and mentioned how I guess one of there was the CIA involvement with it, and one of her former students had gone to work for USIP. But to me, if there's concern that the USIP has been hijacked, for want of a better word, or neutralized is probably a more accurate term, neutralized by being only a token organization without any without sufficient funding, without sufficient resources. It's just a token organization that people just pat on the back and say, you know, good for you, and they don't take it seriously. Then the answer to that problem is for organizations like the Quincy Institute and others to help publicize them and create support for more funding, because it's a resource that, you know, it was created in 1984, 35 mm-hmm. years ago, and it was created by members of Congress who were World War II veterans, who learned from their own experience in World War II that they wanted to create an organization that would be kind of the peace-promoting counterweight to the U.S. military academies. That was just part of their mission, not the only mission, but an educational mission. But it's also an action organization out in the field, but not having as much impact as ideally it should. But in any event, I hope our audience found that interesting. Check out the Quincy Institute website and learn more about the organization. There's a lot of good stuff, and their website has added a tremendous amount of information almost every day just over the last week. So, all right, let's move on to our second segment tonight. Richard, I know you have a lot to tell us, share with us about the new types of video conference video hearings that they have with the BVA, the Board of Veterans Appeals. What can you share with us?
Well, it's a great, I'm usually pretty negative when it comes to the VA and the BVA, but I got to tell you, they hit the nail right in the head on this one. It's a home run. So basically, if you have a hearing scheduled for before the Board of Veteran Appeals, and you have you don't want to travel to the regional office where it's going to be held, then you can request, if you're representing yourself, you can request it on your own, or if you have a representative, you can ask the representative to do it, that you have your BVA hearing done by a video, just like they would do down at the regional office, if they weren't doing a live hearing. It's no different than if you were Skyping. It's a pretty simple setup, and we were able to connect very, very easily. There was a couple of glitches when we started, but once we got rolling, it all worked out great. We had a nice 90-minute hearing. I know my veteran felt very comfortable. He came to the office. He got a chance to relax, had a cup of coffee, and just had a chance to breathe before he then had to go in and testify before the hearing. So I know from the veteran's point of view, it was extremely beneficial. I also found it extremely less formal than if you were down at the regional office. You didn't have other people running in and out of the room. You didn't feel like you were pressed for time. I know St. Pete for some reason says you think you get like a 30-minute hearing. We had none of that. We were in there for an hour and a half.
Wow.
Actually, it was a little more than an hour and a half. And we had this great give and take back and forth. Now, I don't know if it was just this particular judge. I'm going to find out again on Thursday. I have another hearing. So I don't know if this was this particular judge. But she enjoyed the process. We had nice question answer going back and forth. She was, you know, she went out of her way for the veteran, not to get into all the issues we had there, but we had his BVA hearing basically involved a legacy appeal as it was as also an AMA appeal under the new Appeal Modernization Act. So there were two BVA appeals going, and she was doing her best to try to consolidate the AMA into the legacy appeal. She wanted to do that for the veteran because then she could keep control of the case and expedite all of the claims on behalf of the veteran. Again, I don't know if it was this particular judge or if it was the format, but, you know, I've done a lot of these hearings over a lot of years now, and it was one of the better ones across the board. So, you know, I encourage you veterans to take advantage of this, especially if you live, you know, a significant distance from the regional office. And that's in terms of significant distance, that really is up to you. But I know a lot of veterans who are 2 to 2.5 hours away. It's an all-day affair. Some of them even have to spend the night, especially if the hearing's at 8:30 in the morning. So you can alleviate all that by doing these hearings, and you can do them right in your lawyer's office, and you can do them right in your living room if you want. It's great, David, I'll tell you. It's, you know, and as the judge said, which, you know, it gives you the opportunity to have the face-to-face between the judge and the veteran, which is so important, and judges like that. Of course, you know, if you can't appear at a hearing because it is too far, your lawyer can prepare the paperwork, you can sign a statement, and you can mail it in. But that clearly that's not the same impact than if you were to sit there in front of the judge and the judge can see your face, make eye contact with you. So it was a good day.
Well, good that's day. Great to hear. And I noticed just from emails that I get from the VA almost every day, I subscribe to a number of email newsletters from the VA, and that includes an email I got today announcing it was a press release dated today, December the 9th, 2019. It said the title was VA's Board of Appeals Plans Virtual Hearings in 2020, and it says, and I quote, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, Board of Veterans Appeals, and Office of Information and Technology are working towards nationwide availability of virtual hearings for veterans next year, allowing access using their mobile phone or laptop via the VA Video Connect app. The virtual hearings are based on the Veterans Health Administration's telehealth platform and lets veterans participate in their appeals from the comfort of their own home. And it goes on to say, I'll skip part of this press release, but it says, to date, the board has held 155 successful virtual hearings. Veterans who otherwise would have had to cancel the hearings were able to participate in virtual hearings and receive decisions. So that is a great benefit. And when I checked it out when I got this press release to check out the Video Connect app, and then it did, going through the rather lengthy instructions, it did reflect the fact that something that I've heard from some of my clients before, which was that they've had medical appointments through essentially Skyping, you know, the video, the telehealth platform that they reference in this press release that's run by the Veterans Health Administration, VHA, as opposed to the Veteran Benefit Administration, which include the Board of Veterans Appeals. So interesting stuff, and good luck, Rick, with your next hearings. I suspect, and I realize this is just my opinion, that your hour and a half experience might be somewhat unique to the judge, because I had a hearing with the judge at the St. Pete Regional Office earlier this year, and who said, you know, you have 30 minutes, and it was actually reflected on the letter, while previous letters, the usual letter that we would get, if it said anything, it would say an hour. And you know how they would schedule at the regional office. They schedule a morning segment, start usually from 8:30 until lunchtime, and then an afternoon segment. And they'll schedule a whole group of veterans, and you're told to be there by 8:30. You don't know whether you're going to be actually before the judge at 8:30, 9:30, 10:30, or whatever. But they really pretty much held us to an hour thing, except recently where it seemed like they were going to 30 minutes. So we'll see. I think being able to have an hour and a half talking with the judge and analyzing a case is definitely a good thing. So,
yeah, well, I know, and I'm sure you're going to get this too, David. I've already probably this year tripled the amount of appeals I've filed with the BVA so far because of the the way the VA is handling these
the
claims
Modernization
now.
Act
consequences. Yeah, so, you know, I'm so fed up with the whole, you know, trying to deal with them that I'm finding I'm just going to, you know, file the notice of disagreement, the 10182, and just get it right to the BVA and try to get it expedited, because I just think the VA is a waste of time.
By VA, you mean like the higher level review or the supplemental claim?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
I had a what they call an informal phone conference with a higher level review. Reviewer, although he identified himself as a decision review officer, it was on a case that was filed just about a month ago, our appeal. We've been representing this veteran for a couple of years now, but this particular issue. And, I'm in Florida, and this hearing officer is in Seattle, Washington. So he was calling me early in the morning his time, but we were able to make progress on this particular case, and fortunately, he, unlike a lot of them, he actually seemed to be rather open-minded about, considering what we were arguing in this case. So we made some positive progress. But normally, I would agree with you, Rick, that these higher-level review, that lane in the new appeals management system is usually a waste of time, and for the supplemental claim, you have to have developed your own new evidence. So that's his own set of obstacles. But any event, well, we're about running out of time, Rick. So you want to bring us?
And I think David, to your point, I think you will find it. It's going to be case by case basis, depending on who you have on the other side of the VA, because there are some that try to do the right thing, but you never know who you're going to get, and so. From a general point of view, I think we got an issue. But
generally the BVA is going to be better.
So our coaching in the care program, which we promote every week, it's an important program for our veterans and their families. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be tough, and adjustment and loved ones can help. Coaching in the care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. The program toll-free number is 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the VA's coaching the care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has a Veterans Crisis Line to help. You can call that number at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line number is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. That's all I got, David.
Well, thanks, Richard. It's time for us to go for this evening. We'd like to thank you all for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli, as well as Corey and Hurley Law Group. I'd also like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom, and we hope that you'll all tune in next week, 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 Central, 5 Mountain Time, and 4 p.m. Pacific Time here on BBSRadio.com, Station 1, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, we hope you have a great week. Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.